Ken here. If you only listen to our podcasts, I want to encourage you to visit unfetteredmind.org. Here you'll find, free of charge, dozens of original articles and contemporary translations of Buddhist texts and prayers. If you find these helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to expand the website and support your practice. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, Ideology and Wisdom, Part 4.
Now, the topic was ideology and wisdom. Wisdom is a very interesting word in English. How many of you are wise? Okay. How many of you know someone who is wise? Let's do this with a different word. How many of you are promiscuous? How many of you know someone who is promiscuous? Both of these words are words that we never apply to ourselves. It raises the question with respect to promiscuity that the operational definition of promiscuity is someone who sleeps with more people than I do. What's the operational definition of wisdom? Or who seems to handle life better or something than I do. There's no sense of comparison built into the word, but the way the word actually functions, there's that comparison. So I just think that's an interesting thing to note. Because I translate, I have to pay attention to these kinds of things. Because you have no, if you choose a certain word, I mean, when we use the word wisdom, we never think of ourselves actually cultivating it. We want to be wise, but we never, because we never refer to ourselves as wise, we can never, wisdom is something that's unattainable to us, just by the way the word is used in English. If I said know-how, how many of you have know-how in particular areas of your lives? Ah, see? No problem with that word. But wise? Very different. Okay. Now, what we're talking about with respect to wisdom when you're able to rest and relax in whatever you're experiencing at the time, what changes? Let's do this as a kind of meditation. I want you to take a problematic issue in your lives. It doesn't have to be catastrophically traumatic. That won't be particularly helpful. But it should have something that's got some juice in it. It should be something that's got some juice in it for you. Something that makes you uptight or causes anxiety or some form of disturbance. On a disturbance scale of 0 to 10, really looking for something in the, say, 6 to 8 range. Not the 9 or 10. We don't have to go there today, another time. Something in the 6 to 8 range. 5 maybe, but not less than that. Everybody got something? Okay. So we're going to go through this in the same way that we did with the question. Let mind and body settle a little bit. And then bring this, allow this question or this issue or this problem to surface. And as it surfaces or as it comes to mind, just breathe in, experiencing it to the point that you're able to without losing attention, without getting completely absorbed or swallowed by it. And then breathe out. Experiencing it. And breathe in. And out. And as you do this, become aware of how your body reacts. Butterflies in the stomach, or maybe the sense of a towel being wrung in your guts. Maybe something happening in your throat. An ache or a band of steel around your heart. There are all kinds of possibilities. Maybe tension in the shoulders or elsewhere in your body. Just notice how your body reacts. Breathing in, I experience my body reactions. Breathing out, I experience my body reactions. And notice all the emotions that come up with respect to this issue. Anger, dismay, revulsion, anxiety, nervousness, jealousy, greed, pride, you know, all kinds of things. Breathing in, I experience the emotional reactions. Breathing out, I experience the emotional reactions. And notice too all the stories. I don't deserve this. How could this happen to me? How could they say something like that? The world isn't fair. I'm never going to have anything to do with that person again. This is the end of my life as I know it. All kinds of stories. You'll have your own, I'm sure. Breathing in, I experience the stories. Breathing out, I experience the stories. Just letting the stories run, but you're still sitting here, aware of the problem or issue, aware of your body, aware of the emotions, aware of the stories, aware of the whole mess. So just sit there and see if it is possible. I know this is somewhat disturbing for you, because I asked you to choose something that was somewhat disturbing. But see if it is possible to find a way to rest in that experience, to rest with this situation in your life. Rest doesn't mean you're saying it's okay, but it's something that's in your life, can't really get away from it. Being agitated is not terribly helpful. Is there a way you can just rest with it? And that invites a deeper exploration of how you're relating to it. You may find that adjusting your physical posture a little bit in some way helps you to rest with it. You may find that opening to certain emotions helps you to rest with it. And you may find that relying on a different story, different interpretation, helps you to rest with it. Don't force any of this stuff, just explore. And if you find a place to rest, just rest there for a moment or two. There's the problem, and there's rest. And somehow the two are present together. And as you rest there, in that calm, explore the possibility of relaxing, being at ease there. Now you may find as soon as you start to relax, you feel everything more intensely. So there's an edge to work there carefully. But see if you can actually relax and be with this problem. Just explore that. And see if you can find a way to experience this problem or this issue and be at peace at the same time. And given the very limited time frame we're working in here, maybe you can just glimpse the possibility of that. You can go further. Maybe you can actually experience that. But it may be just glimpsing the possibility today. And so you let yourself move in that direction. Experiencing the problem and being at peace at the same time. Perhaps it's unimaginable. Okay. Then that's what you experience now. Okay. What was your experience here?
At first, my shoulders stiffened up, and I could feel a lot of tension. And gradually, my body relaxed more with the out-breath than with the in-breath. The in-breath was much sharper, even to the very end. I could still feel a little bit of tension, but my body completely relaxed on the out-breath.
And your relationship with the problem or issue?
My relationship?
Yeah.
I'll have to see.
Yes, but during this period, do you notice any difference between... I'm looking for a before and after thing here.
Oh, yes. It seemed less acute.
Less acute.
As the session wore on.
Did your perception of it change in any way?
Yes, I think it did. I think I felt less troubled by it. It was less of a, seemed to, at the end, it was perhaps less of a challenge.
Less of a challenge.
Less of a challenge.
So you can see how to proceed with it.
Exactly.
Okay, very good.
Exactly.
Anybody else?
I will go one step further from what Eleanor said. When I envisioned the problem that I was envisioning, and I worked on it, as you said, in, out, in, out, after a while, it just evaporated. And consequently, hopefully, in the future, it'll be gone from my psyche.
So you have this problem. And now you feel you don't really have to do anything about it. Knock on wood. Okay. Good. Anybody else? Gita?
The problem that I was looking at gives me a feeling of helplessness. And I found that I was actually able to rest feeling completely helpless in the face of this problem. So the problem is still there, and it's still the same, but it's very different to be able to just say, I'm completely helpless here, and to be able to rest with that.
It takes away a lot of fight, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Anybody else? This is, for my purposes, this was very helpful. Because it's all about me, you see. Just want to get, just so there's no confusion here. You know. In each of the three responses, can you recognize an element of wisdom? In Eleanor's response, when she relaxed, she saw a way forward. Tom's response, and Tom's experience, it was, I really don't need to worry about this. I don't need this one to stew around. And right now it doesn't. Maybe it'll come back, but I see that I don't actually need to do anything about this. And in Gita's, here's a situation, and you say, oh, I can't do anything about this. Now, one of the things that I found, both through my own experience, but also working with students and people over the years, is that when we see and accept what is true, mind and body both relax. Even if what we see is painful. Mind and body both relax. So in Gita's case, if you'd been talking with a friend about this, your friend might have said to you, no, when I listen to everything I have to say, I don't think you can do anything in this. And if you could take that in, you go, you're right. And you'd be where you are right now. I'm like, okay, nothing I can do here. Don't like it, but that's how it is. So these are all different elements of wisdom, and there are other, many other aspects to wisdom. How does this come about? This comes about by opening and joining with the actual experience. It doesn't come from thinking about it, though for some people, thinking about it is how they join with the experience. It comes from actually joining with the experience, opening to it, so you experience it completely. And going back to the story about fire, this is how you make fire. This is what spiritual practice is actually about. This is how you find, I asked the question, how many of you want to be at peace with your life? This is how you find peace. You find peace by learning how to experience whatever's arising and be at peace at the same time. That's a skill. It requires some capacity, requires a certain amount of willingness. But it's something that we can develop. Some people more than others. There's always a bit of talent around these things. But it's very, very doable in most cases. I would say probably, I don't want to say all, because there can be some really gnarly stuff. But in terms of the fire story, that's how you make fire. Now, when you do this, as we heard these three people describe, there's an experience of an opening. Okay? It may not be the opening you had in mind, but there's an experience of an opening which changes. And one way to look at wisdom is, and to look at being awake or whatever word we want to call it, it's being able to open to the experience of something so that something else opens. A way opens, and that way may be, I don't know, this is just stuff, I can let it go. Or, I actually see a way forward. Or, there isn't anything to do. Those are all possible openings. Many, many other possibilities, of course. Now, ideally, we leave it there and go on to the next thing. But here's what usually happens. First, it was an opening. Then, a memory. Because when we've experienced an opening like that, how many of you like to go back to it? How successful are you in going back to it? It can't go back. During that Dzogchen retreat I was telling you about, I had certain experiences. I actually can remember them quite vividly. And I can't go back there. There is no way. Nothing is ever the same twice. You know, T.S. Eliot writes about that in Four Quartets. You know, we get on a train, we're a different person when we get off, simply because of the passage of time. Can never go back. So, first there's an opening, then there's a memory. And we try to hold on to it. But we can't hold on to it, so now it becomes an idea. And we see this in the course in the history of religions all the time. There's an opening. Somebody remembers it, tries to convey it to another student. They call it something. Buddha nature. It's a word that means something to the person who uses it, but the student, it's an idea. What does the student do with it? Thinks about it. When we have this wonderful koan from the Chinese, does a dog have Buddha nature? To which the reply in Chinese is mu. Now, mu basically means no or nothing or no thing. Personally, I think if we were to translate this into colloquial English, it would be like you going to one of the great masters and saying, does a dog have Buddha nature? And he goes, haven't got a clue. No idea. Now, if you were to go one of the great masters and said, does a dog have Buddha nature? And he said, I've got no idea. What would you do? What would you do, Francesco?
I know my dog has Buddha nature.
You know your dog has Buddha nature. May I offer an observation or a hypothesis? It may be a way you interpret something you see. No. Because I have a question you can ask me. You can ask me, what is Buddha nature? I haven't got a clue. And I'm not joking. I have given many, many talks over the years about Buddha nature. I have many, many very good replies. But if you ask me, what is Buddha nature? I don't have a clue anymore. So, one time I did know, but now I don't.
Can I take my interpretation of it?
Please hand him a microphone. Ah, it's disappeared. Is your interpretation of Buddha nature? Okay, is that what you're going to talk about?
Yeah.
I don't want to go there right now because we've got time. If we have time at the end, we'll come back to it, but I can't promise, okay? Because I'm on a roll here, you see, and it's all about me anyway. First, it was an opening, then a memory, then an idea. Unnoticed, it became a belief. That may have some relevance here. How many, now nobody's going to answer this in the affirmative right after that, but I'll just say it. How many of you believe in Buddha nature? You see? But by this time it becomes a belief, it's quite removed from the experience. It doesn't stop there. It then becomes an ideology. There were serious schisms, still are, in Buddhism about Buddha nature. I have a good friend who's a Theravadan teacher. And when I say some things, he looks at me and says, oh, you Mahayana essentialists. And I just, the first time he said that to me, I just had to laugh. Because the Mahayana people are always beating up the Hinayana people as not having emptiness, etc., etc., etc. And I discovered that the Theravadins have been beating up the Mahayanists for centuries too. Oh, you people believe in Buddha nature. But we know there's no Buddha nature because there's no ground to anything. How can there be a Buddha nature? This is just you're just allowing the concept of soul to sneak back into Buddhism. You know, but that's not the true Buddhism. We have the true Buddhism. So beliefs become ideologies. Now, something very important happens here. What do you experience when you encounter someone who doesn't share your belief? Yes, say a word about that.
Me?
Yeah. Your expression spoke volumes. I'd like you to translate it. What happens when you encounter someone who doesn't share your belief?
I feel shock.
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 Okay.
Just for a second.
And then?
Well, they're not trying to go into acceptance.
Ah. So something happened between the shock and the acceptance.
Softening.
No.
No?
No. Radical hardening. But you're working really hard to undo with acceptance. But you wouldn't have to, if that hardening hadn't taken place.
Oh, yeah, the shock was hardening, is what
you
said.
So there's shock, and then there's...
Right.
They just became the enemy.
Yes.
Like that. Now, this is one of the central problems in the world today. The West is a little further ahead than much of the rest of the world in terms of how do you live in a society where people have fundamentally different beliefs. You know how the West came to that?
West.
No, I'm talking about Western Europe here. Long before, it was really before America got settled. America was being settled at the time. You have to go back to a period of time called the 30 Years' War, which followed the Reformation. And Martin Luther's reformation of Catholic doctrine principles had pervaded Germany, and France was a Catholic country. Now, there are various economic reasons, as there always are, for wars. But those countries went into a 30-year war, which became polarized completely around Catholic versus Protestant. They couldn't tolerate each other's belief. There was a similar thing that went on in England with the Civil War, the War of the Roses, which is bad enough. But the 30 Years' War on the continent was horrific. It's estimated that between a third and a half of Germany's population died. And the war only ended because both sides were exhausted. I said, we can't fight about this anymore. We don't have anything left to fight with. Run out of people to kill. And I said, I guess we'll just have to learn to live together. That's how difficult it is for societies with different beliefs to come to terms. We're seeing a similar war being waged now between beliefs in certain things and old traditional beliefs and old ways of approach. Neither are wrong in and of themselves. Some of those ways of life have existed for centuries. But now, because of the globalization, things like that, these different belief systems have come into unavoidable contact. Before, they would just avoid contact. And the result is war, which will probably go on for quite a long time until both sides get exhausted and say, okay, learn to live together in a different way. This is the unhappy story of human history. And it's why I wanted to talk about it a bit, because when That's just at the level of belief. Something quite different starts to happen at the level of ideology. Because at the level of ideology, the belief is hardened to the perspective that you have the right answer, that your way is the right way. Your way is the way the world should be. And one of the products of the Age of Enlightenment was the emergence of the justification of the slaughter of people who didn't share your belief in how the world should be. This was pioneered by the Jacobins in France and reached its full flowering in the Stalin and the fascist regimes of Hitler and Mussolini and so forth, and the communist regimes of Lenin and Stalin, etc., where you could kill people in order to make the world better, and produces such idiocies, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. This is ideology speaking. And the difference between belief and ideology is that a belief, even though you experience that shock, and it was wonderful what you offered here, because the first thing you did was try to accept. Okay? There's still an element of compassion, of acknowledging the experience of the other in belief. In ideology, that is closed, and that's what allows the justification that you can remove these people from society, do whatever you want to them, and torture and things like that. And that's why, in my view, ideology is so dangerous. And whenever I run into people with very, very fixed opinions and views, I get very, very careful. Because the more fixed those views are, the greater is the potential for violence. So what I wanted to do here was to trace how wisdom, when it is not something living, something that is coming up in each moment, and because of that, unrecoverable, it's each moment, you can't go back. But when you try to hold on to it, there's just this slippery slope of a memory, an idea, a belief, and we usually don't notice that transition to an ideology, to a casus belli, a reason for war. And I've used very dramatic examples. But we don't have to go to international affairs. How many of you have experienced not being on speaking terms with your parents or your siblings? Casus belli. Yeah. Okay. Now, the core of this is compassion. I came to this through a few different routes. The three principal ones. After reading Brian Victoria's book on Zen at War, in which he describes how many of the very highly regarded Zen teachers fully supported the completely bogus notion that the Japanese army was the instrument of karma, which was completely analogous to the Crusades being regarded as the instrument of God's will, equally as bogus. I asked myself the question, what is the quality that allows us to see the problems in our own culture when we don't have the opportunity to step out of it? One of the great advantages of stepping out of one's own culture is you get to see your own culture through different eyes. That's why living for a while in another country is just a really good thing to do, if you have that opportunity. But historically, there have always been people who have never left their home country who could see the shortcomings of the culture. Suzuki Roshi was one of them. Suzuki Roshi was a pacifist during the war. He did not support the war effort, and he was judged harshly. Before he came to America, he was judged as a stupid country priest and was not particularly high-ranking in the Japanese hierarchy. He was very low-ranking, actually. But he came to America, and we all know what he accomplished here, which is quite extraordinary. So here was a product of his own culture who could see the shortcomings of it. What is the quality? And I realized it wasn't insight. It was compassion. Because compassion puts you in touch with suffering wherever it is, even if it is caused by your own culture. And we see this in sub-Saharan Africa today, in the work against female genital mutilation and so forth. We see it, it used to be the case in many Islamic cultures where you had people who could see things very, very clearly. And for long periods of Islam's history, they were able, they had multicultural societies and actually governed them fairly well. And I'm a friend of my mother's in England. I would really have liked to have known her when she was young. She was quite remarkable. But she said to my mother once, if you ever commit murder, come here. And it was just that flowering of love and compassion. She was an old Yorkshire woman, but she could just see things how they were. So that was one strand. Compassion is essential, is the essential quality to be able to see the suffering created by your own culture. And we can see the absence and the presence of that in American culture in all kinds of different quarters. The second strand was Karen Armstrong's book, not The History of God, but The Battle for God, which is a very detailed history of fundamentalism in the Abrahamic traditions. And in that, along with other writers, John Gray, who's at the London School of Economics, approaches things from a completely different point of view but comes to the same conclusion, that it is the definitive spiritual quality is compassion, because it puts you in touch with what the other person is experiencing. And the third strain was my experience of a completely disastrous retreat a few years ago, which I thought I'd do a few days retreat because I wanted to prepare, revisit a practice that I was going to be teaching that summer. And somebody opened up the gates of hell and let them into my cabin. I couldn't do any kind of meditation for the 5 days. It was absolutely impossible. It was so devastating. I really figured I should give up teaching completely after that. As it turned out, I'd arranged to meet an old colleague in the town just outside the place where I'd done the retreat. And so this is rather fresh on my mind when I met him. So I sat down and caught up a little bit. Then he said, "How are you, Ken?" He said, "Well, I've got a little bit of a problem right now." I described it. Now, this is wonderful. You know what he did? Any guesses?
He laughed.
He laughed. He laughed long and he laughed hard. When I finally picked him up and put him back on his chair, he gave me a wonderful line, which he'd learned from Lama Yeshe. The only reason we seek to know emptiness is so that we can be compassionate. So when I had this request from Joanne, how does compassion help you understand mind nature? It's actually the reverse. When you have an experience of Buddha nature or mind nature or emptiness or the perfection of wisdom or original purity or ordinary knowing or awareness itself, or shall I go on? You get the idea. There's 50 billion names for this. You know you are not a thing. That's very problematic because you've been going on through your life not sure of who you are necessarily, but pretty confident you are someone and something. And then suddenly you find out you aren't. Now, that's very disturbing to a lot of parts of us. A lot of parts of us just get up and they stage a rebellion right there. But it does create some interesting possibilities. It means you are free to respond to any situation in whatever way that situation requires. This is what I feel skillful means, or as your translation is, expedient means. I don't like the term expedient there. It's too manipulative, carries that thing. I don't really like the translation skillful means either, but we won't get into the translation problem now. Because when you have that quality, or when you know that, in your own experience, and you can say that the whole point is to experience that you don't exist as you think you do, then it becomes possible to respond to anything in the way that's appropriate for that situation. And what Gita offered in this reflection, she saw that there was nothing to do except the situation as it is. That's a response, and you can be at peace with that. In other situations, you can move in and do something. But it's no longer about addressing the discomfort in oneself. It's about seeing how things are out of balance and what you can do to move them into balance, or towards balance at least. So in this view, emptiness is the means to compassion, which kind of turns things around from the rhetoric that one usually hears. As I was engaging these reflections, I found that I came to something else. Every one of the world's great religions screws up when it comes to compassion. Every one of them has their own distinctive way of avoiding compassion. How does Hinduism avoid compassion? Bliss. I'm talking about the spiritual practice, not the, that would be a very interesting thing to look at the social institutions involved, because you get the same kind of thing coming out of it. But I'm looking at how this, the emphasis in the spiritual practice. Hinduism avoids compassion by focusing on bliss. How does Christianity avoid compassion? I think it's being a little unkind. I would say devotion. Devotion to Christ. How does Judaism avoid compassion? I had to ask a Jewish friend of mine this, but he answered it in precisely 1 millisecond. No, there has to be an actual spiritual practice. Guilt isn't much of a spiritual practice. Yeah, well, you and Catholics, you know. Pardon? Very close. Debate over the Torah. Now, there's an extraordinary amount of wisdom in Judaism. But what do they love to do? Endless debates over the minutiae of the interpretation of the Torah. You know, volumes and volumes and volumes for centuries. How does Buddhism avoid compassion? How does Buddhism avoid compassion? Emptiness. Non-self, etc. Let's go in that direction. No, it just gets you, as a very much thing, you think that emptiness and non-self is the answer to everything. It's not. It's the means to the answer. Compassion is the answer. You follow? Oh, in theory, yes. But as Yogi Berra wonderfully said, in theory, there's no difference between practice and theory. In practice, there is. Because if you look at where people actually put their time and energy, it's the rare individual who puts their time and energy into compassion. They put far more time and energy into emptiness. This goes back to Atisha. Atisha had 3 great students. I think I've got it right. Yeah. And I can never remember their names. They're in Great Path of Awakening. And on one occasion, he asked his attendant, what's student A doing? And by this time, all of these were notable teachers in their own right. So what's student A doing? Oh, he's giving a lecture on the Abhidharma. Okay, very good. What's student B doing? Oh, he's supervising the construction of a new monastery. Oh, very good. What's student C doing? Student C is sitting in the corner of a room with a towel wrapped around his head, sobbing his eyes out. And Atisha took off his hat and bowed in that direction and said, he's cultivating compassion. So, a couple of themes to wrap up, points to wrap up. The aim, or I have to speak individually because each of you have to decide this for yourselves. Among the more useful questions I found in practice is, how can I experience this and be at peace at the same time? If you engage that question and engage it deeply with any of the tools that we've discussed today, or with any of the other tools that you know, Yidam practice, taking and sending, Mahamudra, etc., etc. Any of these tools. it's possible you will come to an experience of resting, of being at peace, in which any sense of I as a separate entity in the way that we were discussing vanishes. If you're able to open and embrace that experience, which is different from holding on to it, by the way, you may discover that you come to a point of view of the world that there absolutely is no enemy. And that raises the possibility of being able to respond to whatever arises in your own experience out of the fusion of compassion and awareness. Because, as someone said, aren't they the same? Yes, they are. At a very, very deep level. Compassion is how awareness expresses itself. So, as you'll see described in the traditional text, in sufficiently convoluted language that it makes it very difficult to understand, compassion and awareness are like the rays, the sun and the rays of the sun. Can't separate the two. And as long as you have compassion in your heart, then you will never subscribe to ideology. Joanne, is there a copy of Wake Up to Your Life here? In the bookstore? Oh, that's fine. Yes, great. So I want to close with this. Which some of you may have heard me read before, so you'll just have to put up with me doing it again. But it's all about me, so I don't have to worry about that. And for those of you who are interested, this is on page 300. It's a quotation. I only ever cared about the man. I never gave a fig for the ideologies, unless they were mad or evil. I never saw institutions as being worthy of their parts, or policies as much other than excuses for not feeling. I believe that almost any political system operated with humanity can work. And the most benign of systems without humanity is vile. The trick, I suppose, is to find the system that gives the least leeway to the rogues. The guarantee of our virtue is our compassion. And if you allow this institution or any other to steal your compassion away, wait and see what you become. The man is everything. And if your calling is anything, you will always prefer the man to the collective. Because the collective is humanity's lowest. And the collective is most often spoken for by people who are nothing without it. Any guesses where that's from? Yeah, you know. Any guesses? It's from a novel by John le Carré. George Smiley's speech at his retirement from the British Secret Service. Not exactly the setting you'd expect to find something like that. I heard this when I was listening to the books on tape, and I went back into the book. I couldn't find it in the book, so I had to transcribe it from the tape. I was told afterwards it actually is in the book, I just didn't find it. But I found it an extraordinarily powerful way of saying, this is what's important. So that's what I'd like to leave you with. It's 4:30. If you can stay a little bit longer, what I would like to do in terms of closing is hear from each of you one thing that you've taken out of today. I'm not looking for expressions of appreciation. I'm looking for what you have taken from anything we've discussed or worked with today. Just go around so you can start. Oh, sorry, could you pass the microphone, please?
I've always had trouble with the term compassion because it tends to make me feel guilty, like I should be doing something that I'm not doing. And this has given me a different way to think about it.
Okay.
I think that I can approach a coworker with some compassion tomorrow.
Thanks. I can use it directly in the treatment that I have with kids. I can use it directly in the treatment that I have with kids about letting the breath carry me in some sort of equilibrium to being open to them and me sharing the moment in an experience, not as self and other.
I think just the reminder and practice of being present in the moment and experiencing that. What is your last line? How can I experience this and be at peace at the same time?
Yeah.
That kind of.
I'll be taking a variety of practices that you taught today.
I liked sitting with the catastrophic moment. And realizing that I actually can do that.
I've been struggling to understand emptiness, and now I realize it doesn't really matter because I feel lots of compassion. So I'm just going to leave the emptiness alone and let it come.
I can transform a problem without destroying the person involved ahead of time, and it allows me to actually come to terms with the issues rather than the emotions.
I think a very useful part for me was that a part of me can feel angry and another part can feel comfortable or feel sad, but it's not all of me.
Yeah, you can have all of these different things at the same time. Yeah.
I really liked your drawing of the five buckets. I got a lot out of that.
Cool. I don't have a clue what Buddha nature is either. Thank you.
Back. Okay, that's fine. Yeah.
A number of things helped me recognize a certain pattern that was affecting my motivation for practice, so I think it's been rekindled a bit.
Okay.
The ability to open further the doors of the mind.
I like the idea of being able to bring up the experiences that I never felt before, and that those can be released. And I think I can work with that and make that work for me.
Okay.
I think I felt fairly stuck when I came here, and I think applying, slowing down, keeping it simple, and applying compassion toward myself and my practice will help open things up again.
I think for me it's that confirming that what it really is about is to just keep opening to my experience from moment to moment and just be with it. Just be with it and open to it, and that answers that question that I asked about how to be at peace in with the world and be in the world rather than in a mountain cave. So thank you very much.
I found the point at the very end about how emptiness is a pathway to compassion very kind of startling and very helpful.
Right here.
I found your model of the parts of I useful. It's something that would be very practical to be able to recognize and catch myself, not be totally caught up in that.
I had a moment of being able to feel the constrictions and discomfort and at the same time the peace that was surrounding it.
Concept of openness, I hope, is a little bit more embodied instead of a concept, and it feels like it is awareness and it is compassion. It's all two sides of one coin. I don't need to divide them out.
I like the most of your example of Freud and your example of Seamus, he said, because you have all those selves popping out all over, and it just, all I can do is laugh about it, and to me, what better teaching. Thank you.
I think the most important part was that how to just be with my compassion more. In terms, you know, and I can't do anything to create better the situation, but how to just be in that. Yeah.
Actually, two things. Just being able to be open to difficult feelings with the possibility of being peaceful at the same time. And also your diagram on the diagram with all the different nuclei, as someone said, of challenging the self. I mean, where is the self? That's very powerful for me. So.
Okay. Thank you all very much. I don't think there's anything else. So. A couple of things. I have two things that I'm doing on the internet, which may be of interest to some of you. One is a monthly seminar on teaching for people who are either teaching or interested in teaching. We just had one last month. We had a few technical problems, but I think we ironed those out. You were on that one, weren't you, Janet? Yeah. And so the next one, I think, is at 11 o'clock on May 9th. If you go to the website, you'll see a never-ending journey, because that's how I find teaching is. So you can just register for that if you're interested. A second program, which we also have a second session on, is called Probing Presence Online. And it's about a number of tools that I've developed for students in LA who wanted to be able to get together and discuss their practice. But what happens in that kind of situation is that people are very uncomfortable with one person becoming the teacher, even if it's only for a little while. So this is a way that they've figured out to interact with each other without anybody moving into the teacher or anybody being pushed into the student role. It's very, but helping each other move deeper into their experience and understanding of practice. So we're talking about those tools. And again, I think next one's May 23rd, so if that's of interest. The website is unfetteredmind.org or .com. They both go to the same place. The other programs that I have up there, a retreat in May and a retreat in the summer. If you're interested in the summer retreat, you got to register by tomorrow, because the deadline is April 30th, but I'll be discussing, figuring out what we're doing with that retreat on Tuesday, so you can read up the information there. And the last item, so I don't bore you completely, Wake Up to Your Life, which is this book, which is, you opened this at your own risk. As Dorothy Parker once said of a book, this is not a book to be taken lightly. This is a book to be hurled across the room with considerable force. But please, if you do that, make sure there's nobody in your line of fire, because it's a big book. There's now a recording of the whole book, which I did with a student of mine who has a studio in L.A., it's a two CD set, and you say, how did you get all that onto two CDs? We cheated. They're MP3 files. And a lot of people have told me that they find it much easier to understand the book, to understand what was written when they hear me speak it, as opposed to reading it. So there are some, I brought some CD sets with me because they're easy to carry, and they're available outside. If you want to download it directly into your computer, you can do that by going to cdbaby.com. cdbaby.com, which is actually a music site, but we may not have made the right choice, but there it is. And just type in the title of the book, and it'll take you to the page for that. So, and that way, but you can either do it from the CDs or from CD Baby. And put it on your iPod and get thoroughly bored. Okay. So anyway, that's about it. Thank you very much for your attention. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and I very much appreciate the level of interest and also your willingness to engage in questions. I've been with some groups, and it can be very difficult to get the kind of interaction. And it's very important, and I'll just say this as a final note, it's very, very important for you to interact with your teacher or with other people about your practice. And the reason that it's important is that if you never interact with anybody about your practice, basically what you're doing is you're taking everything into your world. And you never know whether you actually know anything or not. But when you interact with someone and they ask you a question, particularly if your teacher asks you a question, then you've got to stand in what you actually know. And a lot of people don't want to do that. They find that intimidating. But that's where the real learning takes place. If you look at sutras, every sutra is a question and answer period with Buddha. And what is happening in the sutras is that interaction is taking place, and through that interaction, the student's actual understanding and experience is being refined by the interaction. So true learning only takes place when there's that two-way interaction. If you're content just to take things in, you think you can do it that way, just do your meditation, et cetera, et cetera, you're missing something really, really important. So I encourage you to make life hell for your teacher, because it's the best thing you can do for you. Okay. Paulton will kill me, but that's too bad. Thank you.
all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.